Can we talk about the real Dr. King? Well, we're going to do it whether you like it or not tonight on the Eight Black Hands, the unsanitized MLK. Pump it up, pump it up, pump it up. We got Philly, Minnesota, and New York in the house tonight for the Eight Black Hands. It is another year of the MLK holiday. That's what we are all going to be celebrating tomorrow. If you were alive long enough to know, in 1986, the holiday became a national federal holiday after a long fought battle with Ronald Reagan and others who did not want to make it a holiday. By the time I get to Arizona, there were some holdouts on making this an actual holiday. I want to talk about it tonight for a couple of reasons. One, because it's become a ceremony since 1986, year after year after year. We have become, I think, a little bit sanitized with the discussion of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life. And it's interesting because on the day that he died, he wasn't a very popular man with most people in the United States. And all the way up until 1986, he was a little bit of a forgotten type man when a lot of people were pushing for it to be a holiday. And when it became a holiday, it was begrudgingly so. People didn't want to do that on purpose. They allowed it to happen. And then year after year, corporate America got involved and all of our traditional Black bourgeoisie organizations got involved. And year after year after year, the real Dr. King seems to have been flattened into a postage stamp. He's become the sanitized, clean version who never said anything other than, "I have a dream that one day, people and white people, whatever."
Right? He said, "Don't do that."
Right? And this is where I want to start, because my good brother, Sharif El-Mekki, who is literally like family to me now and a good brother, so I pay attention to things that he says. He put out a tweet this week that said, "I'll trade you." Now, Sharif, correct me if I got this wrong. You said, "I'll trade you I have a dream for all white people are racist."
Most. It said most.
Listen, I'm just trying to.
You expanded it. Yes. That.
So tell me, what did you mean by that? "I'll trade you one I have a dream for."
Yeah.
What is it? The most white folks are racist. Tell me the meaning behind that.
Yeah. So I just feel like the ESPN joint, explain your tweet to the young boy. I forget his name. But yeah, this is so the idea is like every time there's leading up to the either when Martin Luther King Day, the day that is celebrated, or anytime you bring up something and you want to push back, they're like, "Oh, Dr. King said that he has a dream," and that everybody, you know, like it, you know, that they use that to kind of pacify the, you know, us in so many ways. And what I want them to do, what I was pushing for, is like expand your, just like we tell people, expand your vocabulary, expand your horizons, expand your understanding of Dr. King. Take it from this flattened thing and thicken your understanding, your worldview, your perspective, so you really understand what he stood for. And particularly as he sharpened his points, as he became more clear-eyed about the America that he was trying to change, and what it meant and what the position was. And so there are a lot of quotes that he had. And I wanted, you know, I was trying to push like, "Hey, look, give us back the I Have a Dream so we can put it in its proper perspective. And you take and wrestle and grapple and sink your teeth in this, that most of you are racist, either consciously or unconsciously or subconsciously." It was the rest of that quote. So deal with the racism that you have, that you institutionalize, and that you protect, and stop telling us about a damn dream, because we live in a nightmare.
And he said it. I mean, we keep forgetting about the fact that he called out systems and racism and militarism and capitalism and all of it, racism, and all we remember is that we have a dream.
For the Ray, that's when you would have put in that joint like "Mad Isms" by the boy from Kara. See, that's when you use that little box you got.
Y'all with your Johns. Are Johns like jumbo prawns? Are they like really big prawns, like prawns the size of a burger? You know, Johns, jumbo prawns. Anyways, we have
that's
a guest tonight.
Full of that word, bro. We daggone prawn.
Prawn, a jumbo prawn. Like, listen, I will start saying it if that's what it means. Can I, if I could go to a Golden Corral and say, Can y'all give me a John? And they bring me out a plate with a jumbo prawn on
You
it.
say that
We're
in
good to
Philly,
go,
ain't no
fellas.
telling what they gonna bring you out.
Yeah,
You
they'll probably bring me a gun. We got a guest tonight. We should talk about our guest tonight. We have a black educator. So the this is usually unbalanced because two of y'all are formal educators who ran schools, and then there's me. You know, I'm just a dad and just a man who likes to say
No
stuff on a
such thing.
microphone. So, you know, but tonight we have something that's different than the two of y'all. We have a young educator.
Facts, facts, facts.
So, brother, we have Ismael Jimenez with us today from Philly. How are you doing, brother?
Doing well, doing well. Glad to be here.
We wanted you, and me specifically, I wanted you here for this night because I always wondered this one question: how do we teach young people? Whenever we're talking about a topic, I'm always like, if you had to go into class next week and teach this, how would you teach it? And that's what I feel about this topic tonight. The sanitized Dr. King is a thing to me, and we got to get over it. We have breakfasts every year. We have speeches and keynotes, and I'm tired. I'm just tired. How would you revitalize that for young people? What would be the lesson plan? What can we teach young people about this?
Wait, Ish, before set this up, man. Tell these people who you are, what you do in Philly, because they think you're just an educator or whatever, man. You like
Just an educator? Just a
just
young
oh my
black
goodness
educator?
gracious.
Tell these people who you are and what you do, bro.
There's no just man.
Yeah, no doubt. Formerly an educator teacher in school for 12 years. In Philadelphia, we have a required African American history course. So I was blessed to teach that for my 12 years. Currently, right now, I'm a director of social studies for the School District of Philadelphia.
The whole
And I
district.
also, do a little side hustle at Penn with the UTAP program, Urban Teacher Apprentices Program. So just like thinking about how folks learn social studies and the best practices associated with delivering such content, especially associated with that deviates from mainstream narratives. So
You better go with your bad self.
I,
Doing
listen,
all kinds
I practiced that in the mirror before I got on this phone.
of So in an environment where states are reversing what can be taught, what would a radical teacher want to teach about this topic if they wanted to break the laws? If they wanted to just go in the classroom and do the real thing, what would they teach about this
Break the
subject?
laws.
Yeah.
Well, first thing first is really teach the unfiltered truth about King, right? One of the first questions I always ask my students when we went over King is, how long did he live after the I Have a Dream speech? And usually you get the answers, oh, the next day, a week, a couple days. And that was a universal answer from students. And I always pointed out, well, nah, he lived 5 years after he gave that speech. And always mouths would drop. So the first question would be like, so why do you think we don't learn about those 5 years? What happened in those 5 years, right? And that begins a process of exposing them to some of his writings, especially from his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. But it also involves his speeches, his speech at Riverside Church to two Americas, right? Read from his own words, his own reflections about what was going on right there. And then students start to be like, oh, wait a minute. He started to talk about poor people campaign. He started to question the efficiency of the civil rights movement of actually bringing freedom or justice to Black folks in America. And I think that once the students read their own words, I don't need to really tell them anything else. It's a wrap. And I think that's what the rest of the country wants to keep away from folks is the actual words and the actual things that King, looking back at 64, right, the Civil Rights Act of 64, even the Voting Rights Act of 65, and then thinking about 66 in Chicago in a tenement building, marching through the suburbs of Chicago, getting harassed by white folks out there, that he even said was worse than his experience down south. So I think that King started
Not
to teach
up
him about
north ish, not up
up
north, the
north,
liberal
man.
north.
Well, down north, right?
Yeah.
But I think at that point,
Up south.
up south, right, King started to recognize that, like, all this stuff that was achieved legally and through the courts was not enough. It was not sufficient. There's even him asking the question, like, it's all good that my son can sit next to your white daughter at the same counter, but the question then becomes, can he afford the same hamburger? And I think that's when King started to become a threat, and still his ideas are a threat to kind of the status quo that exists today.
That's a deep question too, that you ask about the distance between the time he gave that I Have a Dream speech and the time that he actually passed. When I said earlier that America stopped being in love with him in those last 2 years is really when that amplified. Why was that? What happened in those last 2 years that just accelerated America's dislike for Dr. King?
Well, definitely his opposition to the war in Vietnam. You know, he kind of burnt the bridge with Lyndon Johnson after that, coming out publicly against it. I would also say that his unwillingness to kind of sell out, to just not become a figurehead, but actually have substance between. So he's like, okay, so we got these victories in the South. Let's go to the North. Let's go out West Coast, right? And then he was even shocked when he got out West Coast after the Watts riots, right? And those kids are like, get out of here. What are you doing here, King? Questioning the fact that he's even out there. So I think for King, especially for someone who dedicated his whole life, right, to this cause, he was bred for this, right? He was raised for this. And to have that stark thing smack him in his face, right? The stark thing of those angry mobs in Chicago coming at his neck. And then even his opposition to the war and then all his folks selling him out. Whitney Young, the head of the urban affairs. What is that, John, called? The association that's associated with the national, the NAACP. I'm blanking on it right now. But Whitney Young at the time denounced King. Black leaders started to come out. He ain't about civil rights. This is a distraction. And they supported that line of thinking. And King had to double down. And when he doubled down, that increasingly made him unpopular. So like many people don't know this, but when King got shot in 1968, his approval rating amongst African-Americans was only 44%.
Wow. I didn't know that.
The majority of African-Americans had a negative view of King.
Damn.
75% for the country and disapproval and 40-something percent.
Where's that 75% stat coming from? Because I just did research on it.
Go look it up, bro.
Damn.
Go look it up. You don't tell the speaker to go do their homework. You, with the question, do your homework. That's what the rigorous intellect is.
About it.
So, Ray, let's jump to you for a second here, because this is what I want to tell you for sure. I got three kids. They're not going to learn anything in school this coming week. First of all, they're off tomorrow, and I'm sure for the rest of the week. I got one son in high school, hasn't had an African-American or an author of color actually in ELA all year. What is it now? We're in January. And they've been through multiple books this year. And I'm still checking to see if it's going to be that same way for the rest of the year. But I think it is, because last year was the same. So I can tell you what's happening in our schools. They're not going to learn nothing about anything we're talking about tonight. Ray, you lead a network of schools right now. Yeah. How are you guys approaching this?
I know they'll learn about King this week. I think if you're in a district in a position similar to Ish, and you have some type of power, then you need to be doing culture audits of your ELA program every year. You need to be making sure that you have books that are that mimic the student population, and not just mimic the student population if you're in a Black school, but then also just a well-rounded ELA curriculum. Right, that has the canons, of course, but then also has like Black writers. Like, it's important for us to be able to see ourselves in the literature in order for us to become authors, and in order for us to become and want to be great, we have to see ourselves in the literature. And so this week for us, like, we're gonna unpack a lot with regards to Dr. King's life, and I'm very impressed with our history teachers in terms of like how they go about teaching history with duality, right? So like they'll talk about the pros of it, and then they'll talk about the cons of his life, because there are some things that occurred in his life that we don't necessarily talk about that can be talked about. Like, he was a human being.
All right. So on that point, that last point, there's lots of things that happened in his life. COINTELPRO revealed a lot about the man. He was a complicated person. We've made him a saint. He was not a saint. Yep. He had lots of stuff going on. He was also very middle class, and I think some of what, you know, we said tonight, actually his transformation was when he was confronted about his middle classness, like going to Chicago and blah, 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 whatnot, right? So he had some things going on. Talk to me, brothers, about what's age appropriate. So I got kids. Let's say I have kids that are you know, kindergarten to third grade to eighth grade to high school and beyond. Are there any parts of the story that you would kind of cut up into not being or being grade appropriate? Like even the assassination, do you go all the way there? When do you introduce things like COINTELPRO? I mean, there's some realities here that are harsh. So is it all age appropriate for y'all?
I mean, I think there's some ways in order for you to make current day parallels, right? So like, for example, you got the FBI going into Mar-a-Lago to search for documents. Mm-hmm. Whereas you got the FBI that's like tracking our heroes to kill them because they're a threat to national security, right? So like there's you can lose your life if you're black and you're outspoken. Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're white and you have secret documents and whatever, like these people will walk in, you can see them or whatever, and you're gonna leave unscathed, right? And so mm-hmm. I feel like we have to unpack the dangers of being a black leader in the United States.
Okay, so let me just stick with that because this partially answered my question though. The FBI sent a letter to Dr. King trying to get him to kill himself, yeah. urging him to kill himself. Is that something you can teach at any grade level that the United States government literally was trying to get Dr. King to kill himself?
Depends on what state you're in. If you're in Florida, you better not teach.
Florida, that's called unemployment.
Yes.
I got to say, though, that's a real question, because for my own children, every Martin Luther King Day, we show the episode 10 of Eyes on the Prize, which does go over King's trajectory, his last year of life, and then ends with, you know, in the middle of it, it's not even the end, goes to assassination, and then even shows the failure of the Poor People's Campaign in D.C. when it was shut down by the government. So, like, for my own children, yeah, they got that since pre-kindergarten, right? We had those conversations. Those conversations need to be had in the household at a young age. Now, when it comes to the school level, I think that definitely elementary school, I mean, the kids know that, you know, he got shot, right? And I think there needs to have a deeper conversation about why were there so much opposition to this man that now is supposedly revered and is like the face of Black History Month, right? Even so much so that we don't even hear about Carter G. Woodson anymore.
I don't know about that, sir. I'm gonna have to disagree with you on that. He's not the face of Black History Month. Black History Month was founded by Black History Day, and that is Carter G. Woodson. Oh. Omega Psi Phi, baby.
Let's go. Don't get it twisted. I'm all about Carter G. Woodson, but how many people have heard of Carter G. Woodson when it comes to Black History Month compared to Dr. King? Mm-hmm. And so that you know, myself,
that depends on where you're studying, and that depends on what you're reading, who's, you know, what you're allowing yourself to take in, right? And so, you know, if you're in these school systems,
you're being argumentative. Let me interject here for a second, because you're being argumentative.
This is middle day.
Yeah, and you're about to say something educated. Now, when you talk about the average American, February rolls around and you go up to Target and you buy your little Black History popcorn or whatever it is that you get.
They got sweatshirts now.
Yeah, sweatshirts and your journal that's going to be on clearance on March 1st. You know, on March 1st and 2nd and whatnot.
Just don't do that to me. I got that journal.
I got three of them on the thing over there. I got them for 50 cents on March 3rd last year.
This is at Target?
Yeah.
Bro, listen, go to Target the month after Black History Month and you'll cop some things that, you know, should have been cheap all along. So anyways, I'm only making this point to say, Ray, what you were about to say was what really Black History Month is about versus what the average person thinks, though. But we have associated Dr. King with all things. In terms of the white imagination and the white understanding of Black history and the apex of Blackness, we have put him at the... Notice we don't have this type of discussion about Malcolm X, right?
Right.
Right. We're not having a sanitized a conversation about the sanitized Malcolm X, right? Because they ain't did that yet and they won't.
They would love to. And look, 80% of the 80% of public school teachers are white. Most of them do not know about Carter G. Woodson. All right, let's remember that. Like, that is not where they're starting. They're going with what they know, who they've heard of, and the speech that's going to, you know, or clips of the speech that's going to run incessantly, you know, tomorrow. You know, I even saw, you know, ESPN and the NFL, you know, they do their little thing because of, you know, and each person that they did, that's exactly what they honed in on. I have a dream. You know, every and I'm just like, wow, this is so amazing. Like, this man is given, I wonder how many tens of thousands of sentences he's put out there, and how many are just ignored, not even heard about, unaware, like just, and all the things, particularly as you said, the isms, you know, like they don't want to touch no parts of that, no parts of that. And they definitely don't know about Carter G. Woodson.
Reef, bro, when I was talking and I was talking about the teachers that I was talking about, I root for everybody black, bro. So I was talking about.
Yeah, that's a very small percentage.
Right? It is. That's 0.7%. Yo, and then, man, yeah, you're right.
You're rooting for both of them, bro. I get you. I got you.
both the black teachers.
Both the black teachers in American education.
Well, I just got to say, the thing that messes me up about how they treat King's legacy, like, y'all ever saw that, like, little kid cartoon, Our Friend Martin, right? Mm-hmm. It takes just, like, very simplistic, generalized narrative of, like, integration. If you actually listen to King, he's very plain. He's like, I'll be a fool if we integrate ourselves out of power. If we just add a little color to a white power structure, that's not what we want, right? But they have switched it into turning into like a generalized, simplistic, like kumbaya, everybody, all the races together, even to the point where we have right-wing Republicans using King's image and words to substitute their cause. Right. Yeah. Yes, and so you have anti-CRT people out in the street with Dr. King on it saying Dr. King would be against this because he's colorblind. We need to be colorblind. Uh-huh. Right. Ignoring the very fact that there's even evidence that our government had a hand in his assassination. So it becomes like a Santa, you know, turning him into Santa Claus, putting him, you know, Rosa Parks was tired. Martin Luther King had a dream and Barack Obama became president. End of story. Blacks, that's black history. That's all you need to know. Mm-hmm. Don't ask any questions. You don't need to
anything else go wrong in your life. It's your fault. Because everything else is fixed.
All right. So y'all want to share something here. Because you are all black educators. I want to share a quote from Dr. King that would get you fired in Florida if you taught this. Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality on the question of race. She has been torn between selves, a self in which she proudly professed the great principles of democracy and a self in which she sadly practiced the antithesis of democracy. This tragic duality has produced a strange indecisiveness and ambivalence towards the Negro, causing America to take a step backward simultaneously with every step forward on the question of racial justice, right? So this is a quote about white lash. And Dr. King has talked multiple times. He didn't call it white lash. He called it white backlash. And when he talked about white backlash, he said, it's a new term for an old problem. Mm. We've always had this problem. Whenever black folks start making progress, social progress, white folks come to a threshold where they say, that's enough. Mm-hmm. Like it was unacceptable your level of suffering before, but now you've reached our threshold of acceptance. You're at that level now, you know? If you taught this and three of you are educators, you could get fired in the state of Florida for saying what I just said, which is a matter of public record. What do you think about that?
I think Florida's got a lot of work to do.
And Florida's not the only state. I'm picking on Florida because it's the dumbest of all dumb states. But if you're from Florida and you're watching this or hearing this and you're upset with me and you don't know that you're in one of the dumbest of dumb states, it might be you. Anyway, so for the rest of y'all.
Do that. I love how King criticizes white moderates, right? I'm really intrigued with how his criticism for white moderates, right? So it's like, when you think about who he would be today, you know, he would be a black socialist. Like he would be a member of Democratic Socialist Party. Right. Mm-hmm. So like you would more vibe with like
hopefully a Bernie third party, Sanders but and
the AOCs, the Bernie Sanders and the AOCs and folks of that nature. So for Republicans to now take his words, bastardize his words and try to make it seem like he would be an ally to them when he totally wouldn't be. It's just absurd, man. Like Republicans got some work to do, too.
I think everybody does. I mean,
yes,
you got
y'all
Democrats.
Do, right? Yes, y'all do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. When he says Republicans, he's like he's not talking about his own people, right? Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. Yes, y'all, your people do. And so do Democrats. You know, They can kneel as much as they want with kente cloth around their neck, all they want, whatnot. They can have as many king breakfasts. And listen, let's be clear. Nobody else on this podcast is saying this. I am saying this right now. The king keynote circuit is a hustle that brings you $10,000 to $15,000 to $25,000 bags to drop some of the same things you've said for the last 5 to 10 years that are not doing what is being done on this podcast or in this brother's classroom right now, which is rethinking the process of making education revolutionary. Why are you talking if what you are saying is not piercing the envelope of the apathy that has been taking place for the last 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, or whatnot? Why are you dropping keynote speeches that you could have given in Idaho or Iowa or wherever else, and is not making any difference except for people getting 3,000 calories in their MLK breakfast meal that they're having, right? And they're all in their best dress. They're looking good. They put on their cool water in their Dakar and their whatever. They got the cool
water. Yo, you're dropping bars right now.
Anyway, but am I lying? I said y'all didn't say this. I didn't put this on y'all.
You're not lying at all, bro. You know, you need to have that screen on you so I could cut that. But
I'm not doing it. Yeah, I'm not doing it. I'm not living by this one because my people get mad. Because listen, I don't mind the hustle, 100%. It's not a bad thing to have a message every year. But when are we gonna get back to having one that pushes the envelope? Now I see here someone mentioned the three evils of society. Does anybody want to touch on that?
Can you pull it up?
Well,
go ahead, Ish.
Yeah, I was going to say militarism, materialism, and racism, right? So even the materialism aspect, we don't even talk about, you know, thousands of objects up in our closet, man. But like we even build buildings to hold the stuff that we own now. And like that really hit me the other day. And I think that it spoke to King's kind of like nuanced idea about the more, you know, we have so much, we have an abundance. We need to change the way we operate. We need to have a revolution of values, right? We need to reconstruct the way society operates. And I think that has been lost in the sauce, right? That materialism, if anything, you just spoke to how even people who speak on King's legacy benefit from that. But then we talk about racism and then even militarism. You know, right now we're involved in a proxy war in Europe against the Russia, right? We're also involved in other proxy wars halfway across the world in Africa and different parts in Asia.
Hundreds of bases.
Consistently would be against that. So like some of these ideas that, you know, King was very vocal, very clear about, they have flipped it on its head. So even think about this, and this might blow some of your minds, but who paid for that statue in D.C.? If you look at the major donors, you're talking about Walmart. You're talking about J.P. Morgan. You
don't talk bad about
you're
Walmart.
Talking about Bank of America and Boeing, weapons of war. You know, these are the people funding these King things now. And guess what's not talked about? Guess what's not addressed? So we're supposed to go to a school building, paint some walls, and ignore the fact that some of the things that King warned us about, that we are headed in the wrong direction, this society doubled down upon and went full throttle. He even said that if we did not change course, we would be drugged down the long, dark corridor of despair. And guess what? A year later, he got shot. Mm-hmm. So like all these type of ideas that the giant triplets that King was warning us about, this society didn't change. If anything, it became more sophisticated about how these things were rolled out, how militarism, right? So instead of drafting folks, now we have folks in Nevada doing drone airplanes halfway across the world, bombing people away from the battlefield. You understand? So like, it's not as present in people's minds. And we have racism now. Oh, well, anybody can be racist, right? Ignoring the fact that was rooted in anti-Blackness and that is still based on anti-Blackness. I would even double down and say in our society, if you can acknowledge that Black people were never meant to be free, like Dr. King probably would admit towards the end of his life, then you probably hold anti-Black views, regardless of your racial or ethnic identity. So like all these type of things, these giant triplets was more of a warning. And he struggled. He believed in it, man. And, you know, there's a great book by James Cone. If anybody wants to read kind of the theological mixed in with the development of Martin next to Malcolm. And in the book, he's like, Malcolm needed to learn that not all white people were devils. but Martin Luther King needed to learn that a lot were. Mm. And I think that that is really heavy when you think of King towards the end of his life.
Let's go, Ish.
Yeah.
Let's go.
He said a whole lot.
I wasn't excited from coming on here to talk with Reef, but you here? Really in the building, yo. Really
that's right. No doubt. No doubt. Listen, it's about the intellectual rigor that folks got to bring to the table. And you know what, Ish, that reminds me of, you know, like even some of the conflict that was happening, you know, when you think about, you know, during King's time, and you have like Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, coming out and saying, you know what, like enough of this. Black power is what we have to amass and organize around. And Dr. King, like, hey, you know what, like, I hear what you're saying, but like, tone down that rhetoric. And Stokely, like, rhetoric can be useful. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to get a point across. And so even that, and then seeing, you know, King's response. So you mentioned the white riots, right? And then he gave language around, like, hey, that's the language of the unheard. Like, you just started seeing him, you know, make adjustments to his conversations with white people, you know, that also signal something to black people. And I agree, like him and Malcolm, you know, I think most folks, like we have to stop looking at them in isolation as individuals and look at them as part of the community and the context, right? Like I love looking at Martin and Malcolm together, mm-hmm. you know, I love looking at, you know, our students, you know, Abigail Henry would rarely teach Booker T, W.E.B., or Marcus Garvey separately. She would talk about them together so that students can understand the complexity and the messages that people are getting, but how collectively it is, here's all the context and all the angles so they can develop their critical thinking and really thicken the narrative about what's happening and be able to like kind of, you know, block some of the messages that attempt to flatten them. And undermine, you know, like what they were actually standing for and what their development actually was.
Let me ask y'all a question about this. In preparation for this show, I was reading through a lot and I, you know, I didn't know where to land on. He has so many writings and there's so many areas of his growth and his development. You could start here. You could start there. Of course, I gravitate towards where do we go from here? Because that was at a point of his maturity and development where I think a lot of it was coming together. But the question that I have is he feels like an accidental hero in a lot of ways. It feels like Ella Baker and others had to coach him up. It feels like a couple of his leadership positions where he didn't really want to take them. He was kind of like, they were like, we're going to start this thing called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and you go lead it. And he's like, huh? What, me? Right? It almost feels so in some ways, I think it's important because he was a good test. He was a good person to put in that role. His oratory was great. He was great with logic. He was great with philosophy. He was an excellent student, all of those things. But this story sucks some of the air out of the room. Like you just mentioned all these dudes, but Ella Baker and these other folks who had a lot of hand in making him mature, I think we don't teach our young people enough about.
No, like, I mean, that's, yeah. You know? No, I agree. I think that's fantastic. And I'm speaking on that particular context, but I'm also, you know, one of the things that we would often talk about are actually King wouldn't be the King that we know without three women in particular. Yes, to the folks that you said, right? Ella Baker, absolutely. You know, Fannie Lou, like there was, you know, there was conflicts and we've talked about on the show, like in the civil rights movement where women were positioned, what they were actually doing and who was spoken about. But then there are three women. Say again, you're on mute.
Is he purposely on mute?
Chris, well, we didn't hear any of that.
See, sometimes when God puts something on your soul to say, no, when God puts something on your soul to say, it's so profound that the auditory microphones and everything else don't even pick it up.
Yeah.
Anyway,
maybe it was just so high. You know, we can only hear certain levels, and your sonar must have been. Yeah.
I was saying, Byard had a big hand in putting women to the back, and I'm glad you mentioned what you just mentioned. You mentioned Mahalia. The I Have a Dream speech probably wouldn't even happened if Mahalia hadn't yelled out at him.
Tell him the dream.
Tell
Mark.
Him about the dream, Mark.
Tell him about the dream. Well, here, but yes, listen. So black women, you know, and particularly, let me tell you, like the three women who I think we wouldn't know King the way we know him now if it wasn't. One is, two of them were black women teachers. So let me start off with that. So hashtag we need black teachers, but especially these
the right black teachers.
Anytime you got a qualified blackness, bro, that's a problem that I want you to sit in a corner and reflect on.
Oh, get the mic, I'll sit and reflect.
So here's one. One is his mother. Mm-hmm. So a lot of folks don't know that his mother was an actual public school teacher, and you know, in some places, including down, in this hometown, if you got married as a woman, you got married, you had to resign your position as a teacher. So some places you had to resign if you joined the NAACP. Other places, if you simply got married, you had to resign. So she had to resign, even though she, you know, went to HBCU, she graduated. I think she went to Hampton, maybe Spelman, the earlier version of Spelman, in Hampton, was trained formally to become a teacher and was a teacher, got married to, you know, Martin Luther King Sr. and had to resign. So we always talk about, you know, a child's first teacher is their mother most often. And that's who, not only was she a mother and teaching, but she was also formally trained as a teacher. And all the things that, you know, his siblings would talk about, like how she thought about education in the home. Second one, another black woman teacher, was Joanne Robinson. And when we talk about the Montgomery bus boycott, if we are out there teaching our students the way that it's typically flattened, that Martin Luther King kind of created the Montgomery bus boycott as a response, not recognizing that Joanne Robinson, public school teacher, was actually the one that organized and started and was going to, you know, City Hall in Montgomery and pushing back. And they invited Dr. King to come help lead it because his platform and his voice has started to expand. So there was a black woman teacher who had actually led it. And then they were like, hey, this has traction. We need to expand this. Okay, let's bring in Dr. King. And then afterwards, his wife, Coretta Scott, who even during his time supportive, but then afterwards continued his legacy and making sure that she was constantly pushing and challenging and trying to really, you know, protect the, you know, all of his writing, all of his, you know, his work. And so these three women, you know, helped launch, support, and create some of the things that helped amplify his voice even further. And so I would say that's absolutely, you know, critical that we, again, talk about not just this man as a figure. And this is what I mean by like making sure that other folks in the village are spoken about and see and connect the dots. If not, they will give you two lines out of a speech, you know, a day in the year, and then say, all right, keep it moving. You've arrived. You're fine now.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, always coming back to the question of what do we teach our young people? Like, what is our black pedagogy? What do we teach even if the schools aren't going to teach it? You know, assuming that, this is my new speech, assuming that every guardian is a teacher, every house is a school, and every teacher is a library. Right. As a philosophy, if you're a parent, you got a lot of gaps to fill in. You just gave us a bunch of them. Right. Now I would have to go to Amazon and start. What did Sharif say?
Or Uncle Bobby.
Does Uncle Bobby's have a website?
Yes.
Where do they deliver? Do they deliver?
Yes.
Do they have free delivery?
No.
Okay. All right, y'all. Listen, here's another quote that would get you fired. I want to get your reaction to it. In the state of Florida, if you taught this about Dr. King and used this exact historic record of his writing, you could get fired for saying this. It would be neither true nor honest to say that the Negro status is what it is because he is innately inferior or because he is basically lazy and listless or because he has sought not to lift himself up by his own bootstraps. To find the origins of the Negro problem, we must turn to the white man's problem. As Earl Conrad says in a recent book, The Invention of the Negro, I've sought out these new routes in the unshakable conviction that the question involved there cannot be and never could be answered merely by examining the Negro himself, his ghettos, his history, his personality, his culture. For the answer to how the Negro status came to be, what it does not, where it does not lie essentially is in the world of the Negro, but in the world of the white. In short, white Americans must assume the guilt for the Black man's inferior status. So the laws literally say you can't blame, you can, first of all, you can't make any one race guilty. And you can't make any one race feel bad about their race for past transgressions. So here's something that's of historical note of a major American figure that you can't teach in a classroom. How do you get around that? If I'm a teacher right now and I wanted to teach this anyways, well, first of all, do you think I should be willing to just get fired if I had to?
Yes.
You think so? So you
I
think
feel like, you're, I feel like you have to, in order for you to be really good at this work, you have to go in. You have to go in every day with the thoughts or the intents of you possibly being fired. If you're right. Black and you're in education, if you're right. not going into it with the attitude of I could possibly be fired today, then you're not doing your job.
So you're a teacher. You got your little pension, maybe starting. You got benefits, kinda. You got a check, kinda. You got a baby, 3 months old, beautiful. Cute little baby throwing up everywhere, but beautiful still. You love the baby, right? You know, you just love him just crapping and pooping and everything everywhere, and you still think it's beautiful. Oh my God, my baby's so beautiful. And you got a partner at home who's taking care of the baby or whatnot. Now, let's re-answer the question. Do you teach this lesson this way, or do you become subversive, teach it some other kind of way? Nah, Ishmael, let's go to you, brother, because I know these two brothers gonna lie. They're not even in the classroom, so let's just go straight to you with this.
No, I'll go with him. My answer is a little bit different, but go ahead, Ish.
No. I was just gonna say, you know, yes, but that's my own personal thing, and I totally understand what you're saying. The first thing I would do is number one, acknowledge the fact that how we're all indoctrinated with a way of thinking of a narrative already, right, and start at that base. And just come to the realization that a lot of things in history are told in a way to fit into a storyline. And sometimes that storyline muddles the truth and actually prevents the work that needs to be done to even head towards this, the process to even reconcile. Because let's be honest, right? Like, it don't matter what, you know, race you are or whatever. Like, you know, white folks nowadays didn't own slaves. You know what I mean? We're all placed in the circumstances, right? Not on our own volition, right? We were given this world. We didn't make it, if I'm quoting Tupac, and that we have to be honest about what the history has been up until this point in the circumstances, right? And that also goes to King. So this was King's analysis, and that's how I would put it, right? This was King's analysis and part of a larger thing where he started to articulate something that went against the mainstream narrative of what America stands for, right? And there's many other examples of folks, right, that have done this. W.E.B. Du Bois had his passport revoked, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, like, it becomes more of a deeper story of, like, okay, now, like, I'm not here to make you feel guilty because you're white, because what your ancestors have done, right? But at the same time, you need to recognize what your ancestors have done and how that is tied to an identity that has rationalized and justified exploitation, genocide, mistreatment, right? All these type of things. And that King represented another voice, or a voice of, I would say, quote unquote, and I hate to use this term right now, the victim, right? But he represented a voice of the person who was not the dominant in that situation. And so I think the most insidious thing about not being able to teach it is your question, Chris. Mm-hmm. It puts the ball in a person's court where they don't even want to touch that with a 10-foot pole, let alone if they even know about it, right? And this goes back to earlier. Most people don't even know about this. Like, most Americans probably think Martin King got shot like 3 days after the I Have a Dream speech, right? They don't know that, you know, he was helping sanitation workers who were striking out in Memphis, right? They don't know that on the eve of when he got shot. You know, there's no coincidence that a year after he gave the speech at Riverside Church, coming out really voice-free against the Vietnam War, a year later, he got shot, right? And I think all these type of things just need to be placed in a proper proper context. And that's how I would just do it. You create a foundation recognizing like what it is now is not all good. The circumstances that have created these things have a historical record that you can go through that doesn't blame you for your own self-identity, but it recognizes the circumstances that were created by a group of folks who designated and identified themselves as white, which is sad. It's hard to wrap your mind around. But at the same time, it's like, how do you expect to even have an honest conversation with one another if we can't even acknowledge the past in which we're all products of? It's just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. They know that if they stifle this conversation, then we'll have a bunch of people thinking that America's about bunnies and freaking peace and that everybody else is against us. That feeds into the narrative that, you know, the delusion that King was pointing to. Mm. So I'm sorry, I can go on and on.
No, you said a word and I'm appreciating it. All of it. It takes the load off of me because these other two bums that we got on here. Anyways, no. Listen, bro, I just want to bring this up. This is not a profound point, but I should bring it up because you know how sometimes people trigger other things in your mind. Part of what you just said about people not knowing that, you know, he went on to do the sanitation worker strike. I don't think that people know. This is a story from 2017 that they still hadn't gotten their rights and their benefits and their money. And Memphis finally came around in 2017 to pay them. What they owed them all along and what they should have been paying them for years. There was still a brother on the trucks every morning who had been there on the trucks in 68. He had worked all those years. And there had been other old dudes his age that actually really couldn't retire because they didn't have the benefits that they needed and the money. And the city finally got somehow put on the hook for doing it. And I don't know all the back of this story, but I do remember visiting Memphis and someone telling me that this was going on. And I was like, you mean the thing that got King killed, they didn't even resolve it after he got killed, even though we pushed all kinds of other stuff through, like the civil rights movement and all of that stuff. The thing, he would be very disappointed, period, in my mind, if he came back. First of all, if Dr. King came back today, because we like to play this exercise sometimes, what would he think about today? I think he'd be mad at everybody on all sides of the fence, black, white, whatever. The thing you said, Ishmael, earlier about the three, what are they, the three sins or the three triplets.
Yeah.
All of those things, we are not just, we've went to sleep on them. We're actually participating in some of them now. Like we have been put to sleep on materialism and on militarism, like the stuff around wars and whatnot. I don't even see it in our feeds, like the stuff around war.
I see more black people saying thank you for your service. And I'm just like, do y'all realize how many kids got bought? Like what service exactly are you talking about? The service to white supremacy? Service to the imperialistic government? What service exactly? I just want to know. Yeah. We say that. And I get it because our family members
listen. Anti-America talk coming from this guy
with his camouflage. With camouflage for, and I say Happy Veterans Day, but I'm talking about a different group of veterans. You know what I'm saying? So like, yeah, you know I mean, but yeah, no, 100%.
And you know what? So the militarism, yes. We've become kind of just like regular Americans in that we are not thinking about Boeing and Lockheed and all of that stuff the way that we once thought about it. When wars and stuff like that come up, we're still more interested in, I don't know, like all the superfluous stuff in social media versus than the war stuff. We don't pay attention. It's almost like that doesn't affect us. But the materialism stuff is something that has come up on this show before. And y'all hate me for it. Y'all get mad at me when I talk about corporate hip hop. When I talk about we don't own the culture anymore and people are selling us.
Only one person on here hate that and he got camouflage on, but I ain't saying no names.
I mean, and the stuff around sneaker culture and all that, like, you know, the sneakers and all that type of stuff. Y'all get mad at me, but y'all some materialism all-stars and fans and the culture has been, I feel like we're in the Matrix. Again, I always got to go back to the Matrix. I feel like we think it's ours.
Why Ray look all confused? You
know, so, I know. Look at him. He's like, what?
Confused as hell. We're talking to Mr. Ziaga, who's talking about being materialistic.
How old was I? I said this to you once before. I turned 50 years old before I ever had a pair of shoes that cost as much as nearly everybody in the world. Like, we're spending, I thought there was a moral problem with the $100 pair of shoes. Like, for years, for decades, I couldn't get my mind around. I remember the very first $100 shoes thinking, well, that's not going to last. Someone's going to, like, that'll never take off. That's a dumb thing. Why would they charge that? That's never going to take off. Bruh. Unless you're doing Adidas on the low end, $100 pair of shoes is
that's norm
just,
now.
Is no, it's the, just like a $1,000 phone. Right, I can remember when iPhone first jumped up to $1,000. I was like, "Well, that's dumb. No one ever gonna buy a $1,000 phone."
It's the status, bro. It's the status. Hey, so I read an article recently that talked about reparations and put the price tag on it at I think between $14 to $16 trillion. So that if America wanted to make things right in terms of going back and resolving things financially, it would take $14 to $16 trillion in order for them to do that. What do y'all think about that?
How much is it again?
$14 to $16 trillion.
Wow.
What does that even look like? I mean, like, that's some ghost funds. That's some stuff that, like, they just, like, say exists somewhere. You know what I mean? Packaged and traded, but doesn't physically actually exist. I would even say that I think Ta-Nehisi Coates and his long 15,000 word essay about reparations make a great point. You don't even need to go back all the way to enslavement. You can just go back 50 years ago, 60 years ago, redlining. Shoot, 30 years, 40 years ago, and then address the injuries that were done in recent memory where people are still alive who were used and chucked to the side and that you can point to. There's even, I think there's a city in Illinois, Evansboro, I might be saying it wrong, but they've looked at the history of redlining in that area and then started to pay some reparations out to some of the Black folks who can prove that they were kind of denied housing through discrimination. I mean, you do that in Philadelphia, man, everybody be walking around with a lot of fat wad in their pocket right now. And the still
Black bottom back, South Philly back, North South Philly back, back, West Philly job. Back.
So like, you don't even need to go all that back, because $14 trillion, $16 trillion, man, I don't even think these people, I think they owe that much money, let alone can, you know, give it to folks. And I think that, you know, Chris Hedges, author, also makes a good point that if it was really truly about that, the best facilities, the best institutions, the pillar of what it means to be based on their mythology would be in the middle of where Black folks is right now. And that we know for sure that that is not the intent, that even if they did give some form of reparations, they would flip it on its head and use it against us in some type of way. Taxes or something like that. So like,
what, taxes.
You know what I mean? You're taking about 40%.
You see everything you said. Everything you said got no reaction from the Republican until you said something about taxes. Then that evoked a response. You saw that, right? You saw that. Everybody in the audience, you see how this Joker is.
I mean, that caught his attention, didn't it?
Oh yeah, it caught my attention. Listen, let me tell you.
He
something.
Was asleep until he said you like what?
Yeah, I paid. Listen, yo, I paid a teacher's salary in taxes this year.
Which means you made enough to pay that.
I'm not okay with that though.
You made enough to pay it. I'm about call to call it a blessing.
I'm about to go through some adoptions and do something.
Call it a blessing. You know, to this point, Dr. King did say more than once. First of all, I think it's in the "I Have a Dream" speech that people tend to forget about. He talked about a check. That was bouncing. I forgot who it was, H. Rat Brown or somebody has this, stick it up. Here we are. We're here for our money type of thing or whatnot. King had a version of that in his speech. He said, we've been issued a check, and every time we try to cash it, it says insufficient funds. He talks about in other places in his writing, he talks about Lyndon Johnson talking about he was going to remake the ghettos to look like these great wonders of civilization with this big federal plan. And Dr. King's response was, we've heard these type of things before, but usually they are backed with insufficient funds. So we can't be jumping up and down for joy. He basically just said outright, show us the money. on anything that you want to do to correct your sins and your errors. Again, unsanitized Dr. King. He didn't just say, let's judge each other by the content of our character. Let's just stop being racist today and move forward and never go back and think about the systems that have been put into place. Never go back and think about what it meant to give away land and to give a land grab and to exclude whole populations, including Black people, out of that. Exclude people out of the GI bills. Include people out of Social Security in the beginning, right? He never said, let's not go back and look at systems, right? And a matter of fact, the reason that there's so much hatred for CRT and all of these things now is because they are looking for systemic answers to systemic problems. It is not about individual racism and individual prejudice. They want their money. And they want, and by them, I mean the people who are investigating the systems using this tool we call CRT. They want to come up, they want to calculate the numerical problem, the data, the problem, the numbers, and then they want recomps for that. And that's why it's being outlawed. And that's why he would be an outlaw. It's probably why he's dead. It is probably why he is no longer with us. And everybody like him who had a similar idea is no longer with us either. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, King was an outlaw. You got that right.
He wasn't a happy-go-lucky dude.
I think about King in 68 and, you know, he was the most peaceful. He was the most accommodating in the sense of like recognizing that, you know, patience and time, and then he gets shot. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a coincidence that hasn't been anything ever since. Right. That, and when I say anything, I'm talking about a purposeful clamp down of anything that anybody that can rise to such prominence, you know, 1968, though not that far ago, like you can't even list anybody, maybe Jesse Jackson, right? And let's not forget that there was some, I've read recently that Jesse Jackson like put blood on a shirt after King got shot to make it seem like he was there the whole time.
Don't do that to my frat brother, bro. Don't do
that. I'm just saying,
I read that too.
Like, when we talk about these things, man, like these people who care more about their image and their substance, like this image and making money more than the substance. And King was the best of us, right? He embodied that, and they shot him down. And so, like, we're supposed to turn to our children now and be like, oh, well, you know, if you work hard, follow the rules, you can like live in this McMansion somewhere in the suburbs and be everything will be all good. And this is the message, right? And if you don't get that, well, something's wrong with you. Something wrong with your folks. Something wrong with your culture, right? And this is the most toxic thing that kids even feel. And even just this far-off distance, like, civil rights thing. Like, you know, making it seem like King and them weren't real people. That they wore suits all the time. You know what I mean? Dr. Ashley Woodson wrote this great ethnographic study about high schoolers' perceptions of what it means to fight for civil rights. And they said that all the studies showed was that the kids thought, well, I can't do that because I'm not going to wear a suit. I don't want to get shot. Keep that that's real. Mm-hmm. That is real. And then we just have this whitewashed, sanitized version of King running around now. Where we don't even hear.
All right, Ish.
I'm sorry, man.
I'm going to challenge you, because this is, you've been on the show long enough now. We could treat you like a brother. We could challenge you on things. So let me challenge you on this one piece, because you just said a lot. I think about one side of the part, one part of him. Another part of him was his discipline. His discipline. He had mental and intellectual discipline about the work that he did. When it came to doing direct actions, he knew why he was doing a direct action. He had this whole system of you purify yourself first. You make sure that you're not doing it for ego. You make sure that you're right and you're just and you're moral. So he had this process, and we don't teach his process. We teach his outcome. He organized the bus boycott. Well, first of all, he didn't do that by himself, but as a strategist or whatnot, are we doing enough to hold ourselves accountable for actually the discipline that he had? We need the discipline too, don't we? I mean, like we have people running around talking about professionalism is racist.
Being on time is for white people. How are you going to show up at the boycott, but you going to be late? Like, I'm just trying to understand how this all comes together And you look at yourself as the biggest revolutionary in the city, but you can't be on time.
You can't be late for the revolution, bro. I'm just saying.
Time is a construct of whiteness. And so I shouldn't have to be on time. I should be able to just show up. Well, I'm locked up now because I was here by myself. Because you joke. I'm like, no, let me guess. Yo, man, the theoretical revolutionary is dangerous to the movement. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Totally. Like, and my only point in saying that was.
And the self-care. Right?
It feels like we're getting half the story, but we're not getting the other half of the story right, which is there's this holding the system accountable, but there's also what we need to do in terms of if we truly want to model that man, we got a lot of work to do. Because he didn't just show up and give speeches. He didn't just like, that dude was deep. That dude like everything that I read over the last couple of days, I kind of had read before, but I didn't know how deep it went. And I fell down a rabbit hole of his sources. Like his sources, going back to ancient times. This dude was deep. And he had some discipline.
Morehouse at 15, bro.
I mean, and what, a PhD at 26, 25, 26? You know, this was a prodigy in some way. We don't treat him like that. We treat him like the reverend, the pastor who showed up and just gave these kind of like, you know, barn burner moral speeches or whatnot. This dude was deep. And he had some discipline about his work, even about his ideas about direct action. And how you put pressure on a system had some deep kind of thinking and discipline beneath it, right? Anyways, we are coming up to time. What do you guys want to say? We'll do a round of final thoughts of what you want to say about the unsanitized MLK, what we should be teaching our young people, or what you want to leave the audiences with, or any resources that you want to give. Let's do that. We'll start with you. We're going to leave it for our guest to be last. So we will start with you, Raymond.
All right. Thank you for that, sir. And thank you guys for an engaging conversation. I'm always grateful on a Sunday night to give you guys my time for free. So
spoken like a true capitalistic Republican.
Jesus.
Listen, so I'm yielding my final thought is gonna go out to Kenan Anderson. This is a teacher from Digital Promise Academy in DC that was murdered in LA. Recently, his brother had gotten into a car accident, got out, and had asked LAPD for help. Ended up getting tased 6 times and going into cardiac arrest. Currently, again, we have 1.7% black male teachers that are a part of this fraternity nationwide. And so for us to continue to lose and be hunted by these cops, is something that I can't live with particularly. And I wanted to make sure that we're saying his name. The media is not going to do it. You know how these news cycles work. You may hear about him a couple more times, but then after 3-4 days or whatever, if we're not shouting his name, then nobody else will be. So that's my energy.
And we should say Mache Ashton, who we know, that was one of her schools. And, she wrote something on LinkedIn, if you want to go check it out, saying that this is the third loss that her school community has had. And this is also the third, we're 12 days in. This is also the third killing by LAPD, 12 days into the new year. So,
Chris, can you put that in the chat? I didn't see her LinkedIn.
I'll look for it to drop it into the chat. But Sharif, we'll go to you, brother.
Yeah, you know, so much, you know, again, Ish, thank you for, you know, representing so well, and being just the deep thinker and educator, right? Like, it's not just thinking in a, you know, in a box or in a corner, but using the intellectual rigor necessary to advance conversations and educate staff and children, right? Because we're all on this learning journey. So really deeply appreciative of that. I think a couple things I want to, reiterate. One is around this whole idea that the FBI and American government put its full weight behind ensuring that there would not be another Messiah. For those of you who have not read Judas and the Black Messiah, that should be for anybody, not just educators and activists, anybody. That should be part of your, not just library to sit there and look nice, but to actually read and get a better understanding of the, you know, the government that you might sleep on. choose to sleep on, tend to sleep on, be lulled to sleep about. You know, that should be part of your, you know, part of your reading. Also, just, you know, people should read his speech, Remaining Awake through a Revolution. You know, Chris hates when I talk about Stay Woke, but it's from Dr. King saying, you know, Dr. King, you know, he graduated when he was 15. I only graduated when I was 16. So my grammar is worse than his, you know what I mean? But, you know, Remaining Awake has become Stay Woke, but you gotta stay woke. And one of the things, the reason why I like that speech in particular, there's a line in there that speaks specifically about not falling for dangerous optimism. And I think that's what America, that's how they lull you to sleep. They give you, you know, you start being seduced by this dangerous optimism. Optimism that's so off base, optimistic just for optimism. Had just, you know, when P said, don't worry, be happy. If you hear me say it, slap me right here. That they're talking about that dangerous optimism where you're like, don't worry about anything. Everything's good. It's all right. Like that level of optimism that's not grounded. I'm not talking about the optimism of like hope, because hope still means that you're striving and working for it. If it's a pure hope, not falling for a dangerous optimism that lulls you to sleep and where you're not remaining awake in a great revolution. And part of that means it's not a revolution going over there. You have a responsibility to be a part of it. And that's the only way that you stay awake, is if you're a part of something and moving it forward. I'll put it in a thing. Amir Suleiman has a great line in one of his speeches about staying awake, you know, and what does it mean? So again, thank you all for this conversation. And lastly, Bree Newsom said on Martin Luther King's day, we shouldn't be doing service and painting walls. We should actually be in the street protesting, because everything that he was fighting for, we are still should be fighting for it. So if we wanted to honor him, that's what we would be doing, not painting a wall.
So for my final word, I'll just say this. This has been a very, I think, timely conversation, because every year this is going to come up over and over again. And we're going to get into the routine that is actually not good for us, which is to get superfluous, to get facile about our understanding about Dr. King and his life. What I would tell people right now is, you've heard me say it before, everybody could be a philanthropist. So buy some books. Buy Dr. King's set. Give it to families, give it to friends, cousins, aunts, uncles. If you are that aunt, that uncle or whatnot, make sure that every household has a library. Make sure that every kid has the intellectual kind of opportunities that they're not going to get in schools. Because I can guarantee you that schools aren't going to be the only place that the full Black canon can be taught. The full Black canon actually needs to be taught. And it's housed in libraries, but libraries aren't always accessible to people. So I would say it's a very good gift to give, and it's a great investment to make for folks. I'm just talking about something practical that can be done. I've said often the revolution will be literate. Everybody on this podcast tonight should be writing something tomorrow. We should be sharing letters. I heard so much dope context tonight, so many dope resources and references that I just want people always to share that, because I know what I do when people share it. I collect it. I go fall down a rabbit hole, and I feel better for it. Feel like I've learned something. We talk a lot about pedagogy. Sharif knows I like to talk about andragogy, right? Pedagogy is about children. Andragogy is about adults. And what do I still have to learn? I learned some stuff tonight that I'm going to follow up on. I hope that you did too, listening to this. And with that, I will turn it over to our brother Ishmael, the younger Black educator on the show, who brought real heat tonight and clarity, not like these old bums that be like messing up the show every week.
Hey, Ish, before you go into your final thoughts, we got to get you back on here, man, because we got to talk about standardized tests. Me and you, we got some differences. We got to work them out.
We got to talk about more than that. But yes, we do. Brother Ishmael.
And before one other thing before you go, Ish.
And before you did.
I'm so proud. Every time he says andragogy, I'm so proud of him. You know what I mean? Like, that's dope. You know what I mean? I love that.
That's my thing, brother. Some of y'all teach children. I'm thinking about how you teach grown folk. Keep going. All right, brother Ishmael.
Well, first, I got to say it's an honor being called a youngster at 41. Second thing I got to say, we can't forget how young King was, right? He was 25 when he started doing all that, man, with the Montgomery, right? he was shot at 39. You know, that was 2 years younger than I am now myself, right? And y'all calling me young. So just to put that in perspective, that's really heavy. I think one of the major things that we can learn from King's legacy is what was done to undermine King, right? And I think that it's become, you know, those tactics have become more sophisticated today. So even when Sharif was mentioning about like how some folks are saying, oh, well, you know, the idea of being on time is like called white supremacist and everything. I always think to myself, that was probably invented by a white supremacist, that idea. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So like we need to be very sophisticated and to understand that as we have gotten weaker in the sense of King getting shot and our folks being tricked and bamboozled, our enemy has gotten stronger and much more with it. And so when we're talking about this, that's why it becomes a threat when white folks start reading anti-racist books in large numbers, like after the killing of George Floyd, and hence this backlash that we see today. Ooh. Because when they start asking the questions, those answers might come, and folks don't want folks to think about those questions. It's not really what, you know, what the answer is. It's really like thinking about, well, why is it this was left out? Why? And that's how we should approach it with our students. That's how we should approach it with our neighbors, right? So we shouldn't allow somebody to just use King's name and image to paint a wall, right? Without checking them. We need to stop being afraid of what our opinions are, right? He even criticized people who held those ideas, what he said, under a bushel, afraid to be called out and be called different, right? And so the world has not gotten better. Almost every indicator of Black life has actually gotten worse since King got shot. And so when we see about that reality, yeah, you can point to the anomalies. Or there's an Oprah and there's an Obama, but I think that goes to what Sharif was also talking about, that pathological optimism to make you think that it's all good or it's headed in the right direction, that the arc will head towards that way. But read what he said right after that. He says, without us pushing it, it just doesn't happen. And I think that's the main legacy and the main thing that students need to take away from it. Like, yo, these folks ain't all good. This society ain't all good. King tried to rectify and labored, and he got shot for that. And he was peaceful. So what we're going to do with that now in this situation? Are we just going to beg, you know, get down and be like, hey, I got what I need. I'm good. And unfortunately, too many of our folks are in that position. So
you said a word. Thank you for joining us tonight, brother. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. I appreciate y'all. Yeah.
To the friends and family who came and spent this hour with us again on a Sunday night, first of all, blessings to you and your family. Blessings to you for tomorrow, whether it's a day of rest, a day of reflection, a day of learning, whatever you do with the day,
day of service. Tomorrow,
a day of service. Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. We appreciate you as always. Please share the show. If you got any value out of it, please share it. Go to Anchor and look for our podcast and give it a rating. That would be very helpful to us. Send us any show ideas, any things that you think we didn't cover. Give us some feedback. We appreciate it as always. Feedback is a gift. We see you next week at the same bat time on the same bat station. This has been another episode of the Eight Black Hands, and we appreciate y'all as always.